move these people.
Good morning, Arizona. Thank you for joining us today. I want to remind everybody that Contraland Movie, all one word, contralandmovie.com, is on the website for your viewing pleasure. It's a free movie, and it'll tell you a lot about what's going on in America regarding sex trafficking. This morning, our guest is a local attorney, Russ Sarku, who specializes in wills, trusts, and estates. Good morning, Russ.
Good morning.
How are you?
I am awake and happy to be here.
Considering the topic? Yeah. Okay. I get a lot of questions about, because I'm a certified closing agent, I get a lot of questions about estates and family trusts and wills. And let's go through all this one step at a time this morning, kind of clear things up for people, and especially now with the coronavirus going on, people are a little concerned that they may not have their paperwork in order. So let's start from the top. What is an estate?
When we talk about estate planning, Sherry, we're talking about, we actually create the concept of an estate. And what that estate is all the things that you own, all the assets that you have, all the things you have control over at the time that there's a passing, at the time there's a death, that's what the law calls an estate. So the estate is basically what you own and what you have responsibilities for and what you have the ability to direct disposition of.
Okay, if somebody wants to create a family trust, I know there's a will. In a will and a family trust, they're like two different things. They handle two different things in or the same thing in a different manner. Explain to our listeners the difference between a family trust and a will.
Let's start with the will, because you're right, that is simpler. The will is an expression of someone for what they want to have done with respect to their assets, their properties, what those things they control when they pass. A will becomes effective only when there has been a death. You can write a will, it can sit in your safe papers for 25, 30 years, and it has no legal significance or effect whatsoever. It only becomes effective when there has been that death. A trust, on the other hand, is a very different and dynamic kind of a operating document. A trust becomes effective the moment you sign it. As soon as you make an agreement with yourself, and that's kind of what a trust instrument is, that document becomes effective immediately. The trust comes into existence. I like to explain it to people that very often the trusts that we see being prepared and that we prepare as well are between married couples. Now, there's all kinds of trusts, and they don't have to be between couples, and they don't have to be between people who are married. There's all kinds of trusts for all kinds of reasons. But again, the most common one we see, and you use the term family trust, and the family trust is typically between a married couple. Those two people, when they create a trust, in effect, create a third person or third party, a third entity, and that third person is the trust. And I know that's an overly simplified way to look at it, but it's quite accurate because this person is someone, maybe even better than your kids, to whom you give directions and give responsibility, give limitations of authority, and that third person, the trust, probably better than our kids, follow through on those things and do those things.
Okay, how does that trust, that piece of paper, make sure the kids follow through on their successor trustees, I'm assuming, follow through on what the requirements are in the trust?
There's a couple of mechanisms for that. First of all, your successor trustees may not be your children. That's again, a common mechanism, but I used to do a lot of work for Harris Trust Bank. Over the years, I was their outside litigation counsel, and most of their trusts that they were administering, they were the successor trustees. So institutions, and in particular financial institutions, indeed, we have a whole category of companies in our financial world called trust companies. Most of them are successor trustees. And Sherry, you used an important word there. Let's address the successor part of that. Typically, when a family trust is created, the two people who create the trust are the trustees. They're the initial trustees. They're the trustors, that's the people who create the trust, and they're the trustees, that's the people who operate the trust. And a successor trustee is someone who takes a trustee responsibility after one or both of those two original trustors create the trust. That successor trustee is bound by the terms and the requirements of the trust instrument itself, and by the terms that apply to it from provisions of Arizona law. And you asked about what the enforcement mechanisms are. Well, first of all, there's beneficiaries. There's other people who might be benefiting from the operation of the trust, and they're going to have a watchful eye about whether the trustees are doing what they're supposed to be doing. And again, very often, especially if the successor trustees are family members, those beneficiaries and the trustees may be the same person. The other mechanism that is always available is the court system. We don't like to submit trust to the scrutiny of the court. In fact, one of the main reasons to use a trust is to keep it out of court. But the Arizona has a very comprehensive operational set of statutes that regulates trusts, that defines how trusts can operate, that certainly defines when trusts are not operating properly. And if needed, the courts are available, the probate court in particular, and specifically to become familiar with the terms of the trust agreement, apply Arizona law and the terms of the trust agreement, and enforce, direct, even if necessary, enforce with the impact and force of law, the operations consistent with the trust instrument.
When you say probate court, and then you said court, can a trust that's maybe not following through with the wishes of the trust be brought into a regular court, or is it always probate?
Good question. It doesn't have to be the probate court. In most instances, it probably would be, because the probate courts are set up to apply the probate code, and trust statutes are part of the probate code. But there are certainly circumstances. Indeed, a fair number of the involvements I had in court over the years with trusts were not in the probate court, but they happened to deal with circumstances where the trust, for instance, was party to a financial transaction. Maybe the trust was selling or buying some real estate, or maybe the trust was developing some real estate, and the dispute was such that it was part of a proceeding that had to be brought into a civil litigation process. In that instance, it would not be the probate court. But when you're talking about, is the trust being operated correctly? Are the trustees, one or more, doing what they're supposed to be doing? That's going to be a probate court issue.
Okay. So how expensive is probate in Arizona?
Good question. I have to step back from this one a little bit. I hear all the time on the radio, on the, I see TV commercials, these horror stories about how probate is so very expensive. And I always look to see who it is that's kind of promoting that information. Probate can be, let's be honest about this, very expensive. But the probates that are expensive are very uncommon. When the DuPont family was dealing with its the difficulties between the various people who were going to each inherit millions and millions of dollars, well, they wanted to fight about the size of the piece of the pie they were getting, and that went to probate court, and it was horrific and expensive and long and tedious.
And their pie got smaller.
The DuPont family. And, well, it did. And the lawyers got happier. Our problem is that that's kind of an anecdote, of course. Most probates in Arizona probably, and we'll talk in a moment about whether there even has to be a probate, but most probates in Arizona are handled very, very efficiently, maybe a couple of $1,000 at most. And again, there's a lot of cases, a lot of circumstances where no probate is needed at all, so there is no probate cost. If there is a need for a probate, then probates can be done usually completed within about 6 to 9 months. There are some timing requirements that are in the code that kind of stretch out that process. But even saying that it's being done in 9 months doesn't mean that you are continuously in court in 9 months. You may never go to court. Your lawyer may file papers, get some appointments made, give you information about what has to be done, get those things done, conveying out the assets, transferring real estate, divvying up the assets the way the will or trust dictates and guides, and you may never go to court at all. So most probates are very modest, a couple $1,000s typically. What always drives the bus on a probate is the same thing that always drives the bus on a business dispute. How much are you fighting? If people are fighting, the fight process is going to get expensive.
Yeah. How can people avoid probate?
Well, a trust is a good way to do that for the most part. Let me talk to first of all about the wills. You can avoid a probate with a will by just not doing the things that would require the probate court to become involved. For instance, if someone in the family passes and somebody else in the family has been designated the personal representative, that's the term we use in Arizona. A lot of states call it an executor. But if somebody is appointed to have this responsibility to do what the will is supposed to be requiring, to do what dad or mom required and directed in their will, and if they do that and everybody's satisfied about that, you don't have to have a probate in all likelihood. If you have a complex estate, especially if there are significant variations in the kinds of properties that are owned, especially title properties like real estate, then you might have to have a probate just to effectively transfer properties. Although there are plenty of ways the properties could be transferred without being involved in the probate process, and in fact, without being even mentioned in the will. A lot of real estate transfers immediately upon someone's death because of the ways that they were titled. So ways to avoid probate include how things are titled, whether there are non-probate or non-dispositive dispositions that are made with respect to the assets that don't go through a will or a trust, and also a good probate avoidance mechanism. It's not perfect. A trust can be brought into probate court, as we just talked about a moment ago, but a good avoidance mechanism is a trust.
Okay, what about writing your own will? I know that instead of going to an attorney, and I had a friend do this, she wrote her own will, but it wasn't witnessed, it wasn't notarized, and it was scrutinized and questioned through the court system. What about writing a will? What do people need to know to make a will effective without, you know, the hassles?
You know, this used to be a simpler answer, but the advances in technology have made this a different answer. Arizona is one of the few states in the United States that recognizes what are called holographic wills, and that's what a will is designated as if it's written in a less formal way.
Now, you're not talking computer-generated. You're talking pen in hand. You're writing out your will.
And that's exactly the point that has to be emphasized, Sherry, is that people, if they want to use that kind of a mechanism to create a will, all of the formalities that you would go through with a lawyer, two witnesses present, same time that the testator or testatrix is signing the will, a notary public present, all these formalities, all the structure, don't have to be in a will to make it valid. But if here's where the technology comes in to be, I think, create a problem. If you use these forms that are generated, there are lots of will kits that are being generated online now. If you use those forms, you may not have a valid will. If you just fill in the blanks, and that's what these forms typically do, they have some typed in language, and then there's a place where you complete some information on a line. In Arizona, that may not qualify as a holographic will because it's not all in your handwriting. It's not all your thinking or thought. And in order for that kind of a will to be valid, you better go through the mechanics of getting all those formalities in place. I tell people, if you really want to do a holographic will, if you want to do a will that is not going to come from a professional's office, blank piece of paper, as you just said, pen in hand, write it out, sign it. It'd probably be good to have a witness if you can, but you don't need a witness under Arizona law for that to be valid. As long as it's all in your handwriting and you can substantiate that.
Okay. I think with that, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be back in a few.
The FBI says the fastest growing financial crime in the United States targets some of society's most vulnerable citizens, children, and the elderly. It's called synthetic identity theft, and it differs from traditional ID theft because criminals don't steal an identity, they create one using a combination of real and fake information. When they use that identity to apply for credit, a new credit file is generated. The fraud is difficult to detect, so to help prevent your child's Social Security number from being used as part of a synthetic ID, the FBI's Jill Adams suggests checking their credit reports and
parents can request that credit bureaus freeze their children's credit.
Supervisory Special Agent Zachariah Baldwin.
The other thing they can do is have their children signed on as an authorized user for their credit profile. They don't actually have access to the card to make purchases, but they're linked to their accounts. This is often done to build their credit.
With FBI This Week, I'm Molly Halpern of the Bureau.
Law Matters Live Show, ranked number one by Nielsen Ratings, airs Saturday morning at 8 when our listeners ask questions of the people who have answers. On our next show, Bill Rowe and Kim Challender talk about census, redistricting, the Electoral College, and securing your vote. Get your questions ready to join the talk at 790-2040. You don't want to be left out. Set your alarm for AM 1030 The Voice. We can't do this without your support. Please go to lawmatters1030.org to contribute. Getting a reverse mortgage with the new rules and expanded limits can be a positive, life-changing experience. The reverse offers multiple ways of having your equity work for you, from a monthly income, an interest-bearing equity account, or a total cash out. Give me a call and let's see which reverse option best works for your future plans. Call 520-310-9900. Ask for me, Sherry. That's 520-310-9900. Thanks for staying with us. Our guest today is Russ Zarku, local attorney who specializes in wills, trusts, and estates. And as a closing agent, I'll close legal documents for home real estate transactions. And every once in a while, we'll come across something where they're buying something, they've got a family trust, and this transaction at the closing table doesn't put that property back into the trust. And it just makes me want to pull my hair out when they say, oh, we'll do it later. Talk to people about feeding your trust.
Yeah, one of the obvious requirements, as we said a moment ago, a trust becomes immediately existing when the trust instrument is signed. And the value of that trust is it becomes the owner of what's called naked title to the assets that you want to put into it. And that certainly would include things like vehicles and real estate. And obviously, Sherry, in your instance, you're dealing with real estate transactions. The trust has to be the owner in order to avoid certain complications that probably result in the trust being created in the first place. So the terminology that's used in the legal industry is funding. You fund the trust for those things that you want it to have ownership of. And taking something out of trust and not putting it back in leaves that ownership interest no longer in the trust. I'm doing probate multiple times, even recently, where there was a trust. All the good intentions that we had about not requiring any probate to be involved were dashed by someone doing a refinance or doing some other kind of a transaction where the property came out of trust. And very often lenders require it to come out of trust back into the title name of the individual.
And that's usually done at the closing table.
Right. And you see that all the time, as you just said. And unfortunately, if someone doesn't follow through on the commitment they just made, you were talking about, to do it later, in many instances, we wind up having to do a probate because we had to deal with that property that would not have required a probate if it had been back in the trust.
Okay,
so
we have
don't wait, do it now.
Yeah, exactly. We have a caller on the line, Melinda. What's your question?
Hi. I'm a court watcher, so I've seen some of these cases in probate court where someone, like two children of a father, could have a dispute, like an $800 dispute. And then it could result in the plundering by lawyers and fiduciaries of millions of dollars of a family's estate. So what we've done, and I know advocates from all over the United States and filmmakers. There's a film called The Guardians. And this filmmaker was in Nevada, and it's a real nightmare. But a friend of mine came up with an idea that you sit down at a table with your family, and you write out your will, and then you read the will into the video camera, and you speak to each one of your beneficiaries, and you tell them exactly how you'd like it to go. You know, my dad did that. He said, I'm not as good now as I once was, but I'm as good now as I'll ever be, and this is how it's going to go down. I want to remain in my home. I do not want to be in a care facility. When I die, then you can start distributing the money.
Yeah. So that's a lot of people want to stay in their homes, and that's where reverse mortgages have been coming in. It's very important.
Right. And, you know, I have a court watch page, and there's a man on the front of my court watch page. His name is Robert Paulin, and that's what he wanted. He's to own the Cadillac dealership here. And I've seen his trust, and he said, this is what I want. And one daughter sold his home. And the other daughter is, you know, went just a couple of weeks ago to, she did a parade in front of the home that he's staying in, you know, the nursing home. And the parade was to wish this Mr. Paulin, a 94 or 95-year-old veteran, with American flags, and they were singing and they had balloons, and he was brought out to the front porch, and the fiduciary who was like running this man's life stopped the daughter from having visits with her beloved father.
It sounds like you need an attorney.
There is no money left. I mean, the father's estate is being plundered by attorneys who are supposed to be taking care of him. He was sitting in his wheelchair, and he loves his daughter so much. I've been to I've been to visitation with him and his daughter, and he just cries because he wants to go home. He doesn't understand what happened.
Well, it's kind of sad because we hear stories like this all the time, and I have a few that I could relate as well. And that's why when you're creating a will or a trust, you want to be able to have somebody in charge of it that you know is going to follow your wishes. Whether they like it or not, they're going to follow your wishes.
Was scratched through.
Russ, what do you think?
Well, I would just add that this kind of a horror story is unfortunately, again, the kind of anecdote that gets a lot of attention. They're the very small minority of cases, but they get a lot of attention, and they should. They're awful stories. A couple of years ago, there was a horrible story in Maricopa County Probate Court where the same kind of thing had happened. Family members were fighting about what to do with a loved family member who was in a nursing home and requiring a lot of intensive care. And the lawyers, honestly, I thought just decimated the litigation, the assets in the trust. Now, we want to blame the lawyers, and I understand why they want to get blamed. And I'm not here to tell you that lawyers shouldn't get some of the blame. They should. But the lawyers can't do anything unless they have a client, and the clients are the ones who are the ones that are having the dispute. If we can find ways to diffuse these disputes, if we can find ways to create better harmony, those disputes get smaller or become non-disputes. And I think the best way to do that is to make sure that your trust or your will or the combination of the two are so explicitly clear that there can't be too many disputes. The more that things are vague, the more opportunity there is for a dispute and for conflict. The more things are specific and airtight, less room for dispute.
Very,
so your planning is very consequential and significant on what happens afterwards.
Okay, we have another caller on the line, AT. What's your question?
Yes, my question is, on the holographic will, is the dollar amount, my understanding is that the holographic will doesn't go to probate if your personal assets before you die are $75,000 or less in the state of Arizona, or is that amount changed?
Good question.
That's the dollar amount that is correct, but that doesn't depend on a holographic. That's true for a will you get from your lawyer as well. Arizona has, I think, a very smart provision for what they call small estates, and they have simplified administration. It still may require some probate, but it's a very simplified probate. But there's all kinds of ways you can avoid probate with a holographic will or with any other kind of a will, and those include using transfer mechanisms that don't go through probate. How you title your house, for instance, you can title your house in such a way that it goes to someone and it doesn't require a will, it doesn't require a trust, it doesn't require probate. Your insurance policies. Typically, our insurance policies have somebody designated as a beneficiary. When you pass away, your beneficiary gets those funds. They don't go through trust, wills, or probate. There are a number of things. Bank accounts can be set up that way. There
POD.
Are a number of things that we can set up so that they don't have to exactly. They don't have to require any involvement of your estate planning.
So, yeah, when you're setting up your bank accounts, if you have somebody you want to have your bank accounts after you pass, just tell the bank you want a POD on your account, and it goes to them.
Exactly right. Or I've seen a lot of people who are coming to me, and they've already put a daughter or a son on the account as a joint owner of the account. If they trust that individual, then that's a good way to do it, too.
Usually you do that and you don't tell them.
In many instances, I've seen people come in with the other person who's taken over responsibility for handling the finances, and they're already writing the checks. Again, you know, if a child is somebody you think is having problems in the community, somebody who has drug addictions or other kinds of difficulties where they're not going to be reliable, don't do that.
Yeah.
You need to insulate yourself from that circumstance.
I've had people, and I've executed documents where people want their children on the title of their home, in case something happens to them. And I always cringe when I see somebody doing that, because it's, in my opinion, it's really not the best idea.
And you're right, and that's an especially risky thing, depending on how it's structured. But Arizona has these marvelous things called beneficiary deeds.
Right.
And the beneficiary deeds, they're kind of like a will. They only take effect at the passing of the title owner, and then the transfer takes place automatically. And again, outside of a will, outside of a trust, outside of a probate. But a lot of these things are ameliorated and much improved by having that trust in the first place. So even mom and dad don't own the property. They can't convey title. Only the trust can. And if they're the only people who are the trustees while they're alive, either one of them, then that's a good control process.
Explain to the listeners the difference between a revocable and an irrevocable trust. I get this question a lot.
It can be a pretty complicated answer, but, so let's just do it kind of simply. A revocable trust can be changed anytime. It's like a will. A will can be changed all the time because it doesn't have any impact until someone passes. A revocable trust is a trust instrument that you can make changes in. You can change who the beneficiaries are. You can change how it operates. You can change who the trustees are, who the successor trustees are. It can be revoked, which means also amended and changed. An irrevocable trust, which is usually put in place because of taxation reasons, estate tax reasons perhaps, it's a trust. And once you create it, it's in concrete. And I hate to say that because as a lawyer, I know there are a few ways that can be gotten around, but they're hard to get around. And I think the best idea is to think of an irrevocable trust as something that you aren't going to be able to make any changes in. So you have to be spot on with what you're doing when you do it.
Okay. So what do you recommend people to do if they want to create a trust? And I want to talk about power of attorney, too, because a lot of people think that if they have a power of attorney that, you know, for finances, that after that person passes away, they still have that power. And I think there's a misunderstanding there.
Well, and that there are ways that can be the case, but unless certain things are done to make that the case, it's not going to be the case.
Right. So what do people do? Let's talk about what do people need? What paperwork do they need to put together to create a bona fide trust or will? What do they need? Or both?
Let's talk about both of those. And again, if you don't mind, I'll start with the simpler thing, the will. Wills are not expensive to generate. Holographic wills obviously should not involve any expense. If you go to an attorney, or other financial advisor to get a will. Wills from my office cost $300+. So they're not horribly expensive. Again, because of modern technology, I caution people against using the will kits. I like people to do things that are as inexpensive to them as possible. But the will kits that you see online, the will kits that you can buy, the paper forms or do the fillable forms online, very few of them are Arizona specific. And Arizona is one of the few states, eight states in the nation that is community property. And community property hugely impacts the operations of trusts, estates, wills, everything that you own while you are in a marital situation. And what happens after that marriage ends, either by the death or a divorce. So the will kits don't tend to be able to identify or deal with those issues. In Arizona, I recommend strongly that people to get a will prepared, where those things can be accounted for by someone who knows what they're dealing with there. And again, they're just not expensive. Trusts, the forms I have seen for trusts run into the same problem with respect to what's available commercially and on the internet. A trust instrument is a much more involved document. It's a much more complex transaction. It's a much more expensive transaction. But the creation of the trust, which takes effect immediately, really answers a lot of questions going forward, so they don't have to be readdressed in most circumstances.
What is the typical cost to create a trust?
Again, Sherry, there's all kinds of trusts, but the typical family-type trust is probably going to be costing someplace in the neighborhood of $2,000, and they can go up from there.
And if you have an attorney or any entity that tells you they're going to take a percentage of your wealth when you're creating this trust, what would you say to that person? I had an attorney say that to me. It depends. I'm going to take a percentage of your wealth. I went, oh, well, I'll see you later.
That sounds bizarre as all heck to me. I can't even imagine what would be the justification for that. Attorneys can certainly charge fees and reduce their fees by doing a contingency arrangement, but that's not going to apply in the context of an estate planning process. That, Sherry, your experience is horrifying to me. I'm honestly never heard of that before.
No, well, he's local.
I've been doing this 40 years, and I've seen a lot of peculiarities. I've never heard of a contingency type arrangement for that kind of a service to be provided. Now, I would say that if your estate is complex, if you have a lot of financial interests in, especially if they're well diversified, that's going to make your trust more complicated, and that would add expense. Over the years, we've done trusts that cost $2,000, $2,500, and we've done trusts that cost $15,000, $20,000. But that's because of what is presented to us. But none of that would have ever depended on a percentage of your ownership interest. That's crazy.
That's scary. That's scary.
Yeah. Don't do that.
Don't do that, exactly. Okay, let's explain to the people what they need. Like, let's say you're feeling ill, you're going into the hospital, and this is what happened to my friend. She wrote the night before she was scheduled for surgery, she wrote out a will because I think she just knew more than I did what was going on and didn't have time to have it notarized or anything, handed it to me, who I was taking her to the hospital, and apologized in advance because her family was going to come after me regardless of what happens. And she was right. It was the worst nightmare. Tell us what people need to do for end of life preparation. What do they need to put into place to avoid the hassle?
Well, I'm not sure. I know how to exactly tell anybody that they aren't going to have a difficulty from other sources, from other people who might want to dispute things. And let me see if I can clarify the question, Sherry. Are you asking about directions with respect to making healthcare decisions? If I go into the surgery and I'm not coming out of it well, here's who I want to make some decisions about what kind of care I'm supposed to receive.
Or not. Yes, all of that. Your end of life. I mean, nobody knows when their end of life is going to be, really. But if you want people to, you know, maybe not resuscitate or do everything you can to keep me alive, even if it's, you know, plugged into the wall, what kind of preparation do people need to put together so that their family knows what they want?
I'm really excited to answer this question. We aren't talking about trusts and wills now. We're talking about a living will.
Right.
And we're talking about the documentation that accompanies that. And those would be things like a health care power of attorney. Arizona has a mental health care power of attorney that is a little bit different and separate. And your living will. And there's some additional documents that can go along with that. A general power of attorney might be part of it. Typically it is not, but it could be. The living will, and I love the fact that I can say this very comfortably, you don't need an attorney to prepare these documents. And the reason you don't need an attorney is because Arizona has a wonderful free access website that has the best forms you're ever going to find. I tend not to use government forms in my law practice because they may be minimally adequate, but they're only minimally adequate. They may not be as good as they could be. I don't say that about these living end-of-life care documents. The Arizona Attorney General's website has a whole category of life care planning documents, they call them, and the forms are excellent. They are continuously updated, so every year when the Arizona legislature makes some new clump of goofy new laws, if they affect these documents, then the Arizona Attorney General updates his documents. They're the best documents possible, and they are easy to use, And they even have the guidance for you there about how to fill them out. They have good instructions, and then what to do with them. These aren't the documents that you just want to hand to Sherry as you're driving to the hospital. There are some other ways to make those available to more people than just Sherry. And there's just it's an absolutely great website. It's free. I'm telling people, I prepare these documents, and I'm, you know, preparing these documents is going to take an hour's worth of my time, so it's going to be a couple $100. I discourage people from coming to me. Go use this website, use these great documents, and they give you great guidance. They tell you what questions to answer. They don't tell you how to answer them. You make the choices about whether you want to have a do not resuscitate, or whether you want to become a body parts donor, or whether you want to, you know, what kinds of intervention care you want. Do you want CPR? Do you want to be artificially administered fluids? Do you even want to go to a hospital? There are all kinds of questions you can answer using these forms, and those are the kinds of guidance that you can give to somebody else. Now, of course, you still have to choose that somebody else. But once you use these forms, once you give this guidance, and these should be notarized, they don't have to in every circumstance. The medical care people are going to follow your directions as they get those directions from the person you've designated.
What's a HIPAA waiver?
Well, HIPAA, of course, is the federal law that protects and gives privacy to your medical records. And the HIPAA law is very comprehensive, and it's very well observed. There are big penalties that apply to people, primarily in the medical fields, if they disclose medical information they should not disclose. So the medical providers, in order to keep their licenses, they follow these laws. The waiver is simply a provision that says that your medical information can be shared at your direction, with your approval, with the people you've given access to it. That can include certainly the person you designate as your decision maker, if you are not in a position to make decisions yourself. That might be a child, that might be a family member, that might be Sherry, that might be the neighbor. That person needs access to medical information very often to be able to help make those decisions that you've asked them to make. It also provides that immediate access to healthcare information to other medical care providers. If you collapse and the EMTs show up at your door, they may not know for sure all the things that might affect you if you're unconscious. They can get access through a mechanism that is utilized through the Secretary of State's office to medical information more quickly if you have executed this HIPAA waiver. And the HIPAA waiver is registered with and remains a record at the Secretary of State's office that it's available to medical care providers 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's an excellent program. Not every state has this. I'm very proud that Arizona does. And it's a great service to help you when there's an emergency.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about community property. That's a big one. Law Matters Live Show, ranked number one by Nielsen Ratings, airs Saturday morning at 8 when our listeners ask questions of the people who have answers. On our next show, Bill Rowe and Kim Challender talk about census, redistricting, the Electoral College, and securing your vote. Get your questions ready to join the talk at 790-2040. You don't want to be left out. Set your alarm for AM 1030 The Voice. We can't do this without your support. Please go to lawmatters1030.org to contribute.
The FBI will train its national and international law enforcement partners on indicators of human trafficking throughout the year, which marks the 20th anniversary of the Trafficking Victims Protection Act. The act provides tools to combat trafficking worldwide and requires the FBI to collect data on the crime. All 56 of the FBI's field offices have ongoing human trafficking investigations, more than 1,900 cases. That's an increase in the number of cases over the past several years. Deputy Director David Bowditch.
Most of the cases cases we see, roughly 90% are commercial sex trafficking, and they're amongst the most heinous crimes that the FBI encounters.
The FBI's Victim Services Division ensures that survivors have access to emotional support, social services, and medical care.
We have to speak for the victims.
If you are a victim of human trafficking, call or text the National Human Trafficking Resource Center hotline at 888-373-7888. With FBI This Week, I'm Molly Halpern of the Bureau.
Getting a reverse mortgage with the new rules and expanded limits can be a positive, life-changing experience. The reverse offers multiple ways of having your equity work for you, from a monthly income, an interest-bearing equity account, or total cash out. Give me a call and let's see which reverse option best works for your future plans. Call 520-310-9900. Ask for me, Sherry. That's 520-310-9900. Thanks for staying with us. Our guest today is Russ Zarku, local attorney who specializes in wills, trusts, and estates. I want to touch a little bit on community property and what goes on with that in the state of Arizona. Let's talk about that, Russ. Is Russ there?
He is. I'm sorry, Sherry, I couldn't hear you over the music.
Oh, yeah. Okay. What happens when you've got community properties? Arizona's a community property state. What happens when you pass away? Maybe you've got a will separate from your spouse. What happens with the estate in a community property situation?
Well, let's start off with a little bit of an understanding about what community property is. Community property makes a presumption, and it's a hard-to-change presumption, and that is that anything you acquire, anything you earn while you are married belongs to both of you. And we tend to think of that as it's a 50-50 deal. If I make $100, then my wife owns 50% of that. What the law actually says is my wife owns 100% of that and I own 100% of that because we both have equal control. So we start with the understanding that everything we accumulate during the course of a marriage is community property. When one of the two spouses dies, if the spouse who is dying has a will or a trust, that will and trust only can affect their one-half interest. And then it becomes more clearly that it is a one-half interest, although there are some variations in that as well. But it's important to understand that when we make our estate plans, we're only dealing with, in Arizona, the one half of that property that we can make disposition of, because the other party has already owns theirs. It doesn't go to them at the time of the death. They already own that. So we're making decisions about only the one half that remains available for us to deal with. And that's, I think it's a great thing, honestly. I like community property. I know some people who come from other states don't, and I understand why they may not. I like the concept, and I like how it works, the advantage, I think, of both parties in a marriage.
So what happens, somebody passes away, they've got a will, they're giving their child whatever they're giving their child, and there's the remaining spouse can't accommodate what their will is. What happens with that? Do they end up in court?
No, probably not. I mean, not necessarily. If I'm giving my child, especially this applies if my child is not also the child of my spouse, then my child has some rights to my half of my community interest. My spouse does not. I guess we can track this through pretty simply. If I die without a will, then my spouse gets all of my interest in our community property, which probably pretty much constitutes everything if it's been a long marriage. But that's only if I don't have children from another marriage or from a prior marriage or out of marriage. If I have children, then the law starts to take some divisions. I can do that with a will. I can do that without a will. I can do it through a trust. And in answer to the question, Sherry, about whether we're going to be in court, really kind of depends on, again, I think, how clearly you express your intentions, how well they are directed. Because if there's anything vague, that's when we see that people wind up having disputes. If your estate's, $200 million, it might be disputes when people invent what is vague so they can have something to try to go get more of.
To dispute about. What happens in a divorce? What happens if, and this happened to one of my board members, he had divorced his wife, I mean, like decades ago, but never changed his insurance beneficiary and didn't realize it until, you know, something came up and he discovered that, you know, oh my God. What happens if the insurance beneficiary isn't changed?
Well, the insurance beneficiary is different than the other estates because that's a contractual relationship. But Arizona has a wonderful set of statutes that deals with what happens when we forget to do something like your board member forgot to do. That is to go back and change my operative instruments. Arizona has some statutes that say that absent other considerations or possibilities, like, for instance, saying that I don't want this to change if we divorce. But in most circumstances, if you forget to change your will, if you forget to change some beneficiary designations, the law does it for you. The law says there's a presumption that you did not intend for those to apply any longer, and that when there's that divorce or when there's that passing, those things have changed anyway by operation of law. Again, there are some exceptions to that, but I think the Arizona law is very friendly in the way that it helps to cover for making that mistake, which is a not too uncommon mistake of forgetting to go back and change my will or these other operative documents. It may not be as draconian or bad as you kind of think, but you have to know about these laws.
Okay, we had a question regarding the children and the inheritance. The caller wanted to know if we were referring to juvenile children or adult children. How does that differentiate with passing of a parent?
Well, if you have minor children very often would not be people you would want to vest title to real estate in or give them direct access to, for instance, bank accounts or cash or valuable assets. So you would put that into a trust. That is to say, you would appoint someone to be a trustee for those children. We do that all the time with insurance policies, don't we? Where we have minor children, but we designate that if I should die, I want my two kids to get the money, but it's going to go to Uncle Harry and he'll administer that money for them, be responsible for that money until they become of age.
And you can also designate the age of 21 or 18 isn't good enough. You could also say, you know, when they turn 30 and their brain cells have at least developed.
Absolutely. And that's not an uncommon provision in people who have large estates or complicated estates or who have kids that tell them, I better wait until this kid's 35.
Yeah. And, you know, people are sometimes amazed by that. But no, you want your child to be a responsible adult. Or if they're not, have a responsible adult be in charge of what's going on. And then sometimes that's where a fiduciary comes into effect. Are you a fiduciary?
I'm not a certified fiduciary, no.
Okay. Can you explain to our listeners what a certified fiduciary is?
Sure. Arizona has some laws. Actually, it's a program administered by the Arizona Supreme Court where someone can take some courses, they can do some study, they can pass some tests, and they can become a certified fiduciary. A fiduciary is somebody who owes duties, responsibilities to another person. A trustee is a fiduciary. Their personal representative of your will, when that will becomes effective, they're a fiduciary. And these fiduciaries are people who are, the certified fiduciaries are people who are trained to understand the operation of law and who have committed to being honorable and responsible in following those laws.
Tell people how they can get in touch with you. How long have you been an attorney?
I have, this year in October will mark my 40th year since I graduated from law school. Been around a long time. I was in law enforcement for 8 years prior to that. Sherry, that's one of my great loves and attractions for your organization and your great programming. I have a nice connection in that community as well. In addition, I practice for most of my time, I'm sorry to say, in this community, in the Phoenix area. Came to Tucson a few years ago. Didn't intend to stay too long. I was doing some college administration work and practicing law, and fell in love and can't leave. And I fell in love with a woman. Now I love the community, too.
But see how it works
we
out?
We are, and I I'm pleased to tell you that we can be reached can I give a phone number?
Absolutely.
Let me give you a number of 520-269-9545. And our email address is Russell, two S's and two L's, at Zarko Law. And Zarko is spelled, it's an old Greek name, Z-A-R-K-O-U, the word law.com.
Okay, you pronounced it differently than I did.
Well, Sherry, I've had the name now for many decades.
So you know how to pronounce it.
Understand. Well, I do, and I've come to expect that it doesn't, honestly, you don't pronounce it the way it looks. You pronounce it more the way it looks.
Right. Okay. Where's your office?
We are at 6416 East Tankaverde, Suite B, and we have some great offices here and an in-and-out staff. We're doing a lot of things remotely now with our staff, but we're always eager to talk to people and see if we can be of some help.
So in leaving, what are we going to tell our listeners? What do they need to do to prepare for their estate so they don't have the government doing it for them?
You said the operative word, prepare.
Yeah.
If you want to use a holographic will, don't use the form. Use a piece of paper. Otherwise, consult with people in the community about where they think they can get good services. We're happy to refer people out if they need services that we don't provide. We're happy to be of assistance in that way. But make your plan. Be clear and make your plan.
And include everything. If you're going to write it out, include everything. Your car, the refrigerator, whatever it is, put it in your will so people understand what you want.
The more comprehensive you are, the clearer you are, the less likelihood for dispute.
Exactly. And you won't end up in court spending all your inheritance on attorney fees. I want to thank you for coming on this morning. I appreciate it. I think this was an important show to do, especially at this time. And hopefully you'll come back and we can talk more about these other two pages of topics that we didn't get to. And don't forget.
Anytime, Sherry.
I appreciate it. Don't forget to go to ContralandMovie.com. Check it out. It's important. We need to put a stop to this situation in America. And until next week, I want everybody to shop local, stay safe, stay healthy, and we'll see you next week.
KVOI Cortero, AM 1030, the voice of Tucson. Trusted local.